The Unpublished Podcast with Amy and James.
Hello, creatives, and welcome to another episode of the Unpublished Podcast. My name is Amy.
I'm James.
And today we're going to talk about randomness.
Yeah, we're talking about randomness. We're talking about survivorship bias. We're talking about how your creative career is probably going to be in some ways determined by forces outside of your control, but how that might be good and how you can make yourself a bit more robust and a bit more randomness proof.
Yeah.
Or kind of like big scary event proof.
Yeah. And do you want to tell all our beautiful creative friends about why this interest in randomness at the moment?
I've always been really interested in randomness and probability theory and stuff, but I've just been absolutely obsessed with Nassim Nicholas Taleb's Incerto series, which is a series of five books essentially all devoted to randomness and to what he calls, you know, tail events and black swan events. And these sort of just like unexpected big events that come along and are impossible to predict and completely change an industry or completely change the world, or and these can be negative or positive things.
Yeah.
And then they're also often quite involved in creative industries as well.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, for example, if you're talking about writing, which, you know, we all want to do.
We are inclined.
Writing is full of what is black swans, and they're called black swans because there's an old parable, or not parable, it's just essentially that the idea is you can't you can't prove that all swans are white by looking at 10,000 white swans, but the sight of a single black swan proves immediately that all swans aren't white.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It makes sense.
So writing is full of black swans because it's really hard to tell what book is going to be majorly successful. Like, for example, Twilight is a black swan because completely out of the blue, unpredictable. It's just this, it's this one book that completely changes the industry, and it proves that the industry is a way that you didn't think it was.
Yeah.
It proves that actually no one saw this coming, but it turns out that not all books that sell well are like a certain way.
Yeah.
So maybe sometimes they're vampire books.
And I'm sure a lot of people would have said, no, I saw the vampire trend coming. Or, you know, they say, oh, no, but this was predicted in the trends. And what do we say to people who
I don't believe that. I don't think anyone would have seen the vampire trend coming.
I'm sure someone was like, oh, no, you know, people say shit all the time.
I think they'd be lying if they said that, to be honest with you. So this is where survivorship bias comes in, or narrativization comes in. So we like to, you know, 5 years later, you go back to take the global financial crisis. You know, after the global financial crisis, there was no shortage of people who were like, oh, yeah, well, it was all obvious, wasn't it? It was all obvious. But it's like, well, it wasn't obvious to, sure, some very few people predicted it, but the whole banking industry couldn't see it coming.
Yeah.
All the economic forecasters couldn't see it coming. Like, no one really saw it coming. And then later you reconstruct events. So you're like, oh, yeah, of course, this, 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 and this. But really, it was actually just a collection of random events that all came together that, you know, they don't look random in hindsight. But essentially, if you were traveling forward in history from before the GFC, they all were random events. Like, they were unpredictable, out of left field things that no one was predicting.
Yeah.
And the same thing for Twilight. You know, someone in the future might be like, oh, of course vampire books ended up being really big. But there was really no way to tell before Stephanie Meyer wrote that book.
Okay, cool. And so this gives us like kind of two routes to go down as creatives. One is to be like depressed and be like, well, nothing's in our power. And there's nothing we can fucking do to connect with our art, and it's just like pointless. Or I guess it gives us the freedom to do whatever the fuck we want because we don't know what's going to happen, and we can't predict what's going to be trending or what's next.
I mean, yeah, essentially what this means is that as creatives, because the creative industries are very susceptible to this, these sort of trends, as creatives, you just can't be living your life trying to predict what is going to sell, essentially. Like, you've got to really be true to yourself, and you've got to make what you want to make.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way to sort of stay robust against randomness.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only way you can't really be responsive as a creator, because, well, you can't be looking like, in 10 years time, you know, this is my overall arc of my career, and it's going to be like this, this, and this, because something will be coming along
that we can't see
that's going to be the, you know, and if you are ready for that, and if you feel like, okay, unpredictable events are going to be in my future, therefore I'm going to develop a really robust creative practice so that I can respond immediately to I know I just said don't be responsive, but I mean like be ready to respond. Don't be like living your whole life not prepared to respond.
And
just acting like, oh, I've just got to do something when something unexpected happens.
Yeah, I mean, it can be so stressful, like trying to respond to latest trends or trying to, you know, predict what's going to happen next. And I think particularly with like AI and stuff, there's so many conversations around, oh my God, what's going to happen? Like, you know, what should we be doing? Like, how can we be taking advantage? Like predictions of what's going to happen with AI and art. And I think maybe the solution is not to predict, but to just prepare to be responsive to whatever the fuck happens.
Of course, because, you know, AI's, whatever happens with AI, no one's actually predicted it accurately yet. You know, it's going to be something, or if someone has it, it's by chance.
Yes.
You know, we don't know what's going to happen with AI. We just have no idea.
Yeah.
And any attempt to forecast it is a waste of energy, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to just sort of prepare yourself to make the art that you want to make.
Yeah.
And then the chips are going to kind of fall as they may.
Is there any way that you can make yourself be a positive black swan? Like, can you like prep yourself to be like an unexpected event? No.
Well, I think there's no way to guarantee that you yourself are going to be a black swan. But the point is to
try I want to manipulate randomness to my benefit.
Sure. And of course, like, you know, the age old debate is how much can you influence luck in your favor?
Yeah.
And who knows what the answer to that is, and it's always going to be kind of slightly impossible to predict.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it's like, of course, if you do nothing, nothing's going to go well for you.
Yeah.
So put
your name in the game,
and the more times you put your name in the game, the more likely you are that things are going to go well for you.
Yeah.
It's going to be really hard to predict which of those things is going to be the thing that makes something go well for you. So it's like, you're not going to know. You might when we were talking to Seth last week, you know, he was talking about how his the TikToks he puts out there that he thinks are going to do are just nothing, often end up doing really, really well. And this is something I think that's worth talking about, is that we try and predict the algorithm, for example, on social media, completely unpredictable. Mm. And it's just essentially comes down to randomness. So what do you have to do? You kind of have to play the slot machine enough times.
Yeah.
And it's often never the thing you think that's going to be that goes viral or does well or something. And I think the same thing with art. It's like you never know
which piece is going to be the piece
that resonates, and trying to predict it. Like, this is it. I think a lot of first-time or earliest career creatives put a lot of pressure on their initial creations. They're like, this has to be the one.
Mm.
But you just can't know which one's going to be the one.
Yeah.
Which is why I think it's so important to have a robust creative practice, because it's like every time you put something out in the world, there's sort of a random chance that it's going to be the one.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's going to be your black swan.
And for me, as someone who has like an interesting relationship with dopamine, like, The slot machine kind of part of it really fixates me, especially obviously with social media, but also with any creation I put out there. Which one's going to really land, you know? And even when they don't, I still get this feeling of, okay, well, maybe the next one will land.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like this like addictive game that you play. And, you know, I don't know. I don't feel manipulated by it. I just feel like I actually feel in control, because all I want to do is create the next thing and see what happens with the next thing.
Well, you've been in the game long enough now that you know that if you're going through a so-called bad run, it's going to end sometime.
Yeah. Are we talking specifically social media here?
In social media, yeah. I'm talking. But also,
oh my God, yeah. Like, I've just gone viral again.
Yes.
Again,
after like a month of being, as you say, in the toilet.
Yeah, like I was just being like really withheld, like very, very low numbers for me in terms of my interaction and just like who was seeing my work. And then one post, you know, just, and it's like, it's been shown to so many people. Like, why? It's not any better than any of the other posts.
Well, so, you know, you look at an album that an artist released, and you know, it's a 10 song album, 9 songs just do average, and 1 random song that no one was predicting just goes gangbusters.
And you can't predict it.
It's just, you just got to put those 10 songs out there. There's way too many complex variables. It's sort of like, it's really hard to explain.
It seems hard to explain.
Can I just say, like, these books, so what, they're 4, I read 4 books in the last month on this, and it's just so much information that it, like, I have the surface of it, basically. Yeah. Like, it's Nassim Taleb is very good at giving you the gist.
Yeah.
But the precise details, there's so much coming in. Each book is like 600-700 pages or something. It's just, it's so much information. It's so hard to tell. I can't even remember what we were talking about.
Oh, I was asking you, why is it random? Predict? Why can't we predict
just
it?
So many like billions of variables at play. And
so
the world is so complex, and other humans are so complex, and it's just our predictive powers, like our ability to predict everything. Even, you know, if you think about things that we think of as extremely predictable, like economics. Economists are horrible at predicting the economy.
Yeah.
Horrible at it. Like, and it's like, oh, you know, they predicted that interest rates would be this, this, and this for 10 years in a row. It's like, yeah, but no one predicted the interest rates were going to go fucking gangbusters in 2022. You know, no one predicted that, basically. And it's their only job is to predict what interest rates are going to do. And no one could even see that. Even looking at COVID, basically, you know, after the huge stimulus payments, still economists were like, no, interest rates will probably stay the same. And that's their only job. Like, thousands of these people in the world, their job is to predict things. But it's really hard to predict what you call tail risk. So tail risk is like something on the very edges of probability that can just come along and just completely change the game. Right. Like a black swan.
Like a black swan,
But it's sort of slightly different to a black swan, I guess, because it's like, what would be an example of this? Tail risks are often things like, for example, in the GFC or in previous financial crisis, banks make a lot of money in the lead up. And then a tail risk is something that comes along. So they're making like 10%, 10%, 10% profits. And then, or whatever, you know, billions and billions of dollar profits. And a tail risk is something that comes along and just sort of like in one day, it's at the very edge of the graph. So it's like both, it's like bad on both axes. It's like, it's like unpredictable and it's a hugely, and it's like a hugely catastrophic event.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and as, because it's so far off on that side of the axis, we can't, like, it's so hard to see or predict.
Would the
and
pandemic have been?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, the pandemic probably was a black swan.
Yeah.
Although people, most people agreed that we would do a pandemic.
Yeah.
Let's face it.
Yeah.
When it was going to happen, though.
Yeah, who knows? Sorry.
I think pandemics come more into, I think that maybe pandemics are a little bit of a different case because like, we have so many germs just going around.
We're germy.
But I don't actually, I don't
sorry
know
to distract
sure.
you
it's,
there.
It's really hard. I'm finding myself kind of freaked out because it's so hard to actually contain.
No, I mean, it's just interesting. I can give you a break if you
and
want.
And then, like, so the banks in the GFC, they make really good profits for years, and then a tail risk comes along and wipes, so they lose more money in one day, essentially, than they've ever made in their entire history.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, these things are so hard to predict because they're so big on both axes, you know? It's like, no one's predicting, like, people are predicting maybe the worst case scenario, banks lose 10% of their value. They're not predicting, like, multiple banks going to zero.
Yeah.
Or people are predicting maybe this Marvel movie will, you know, be 100 million off the box office. No one's predicting it's going to be, lose $1 billion
or
lose its entire budget, essentially. No one's predicting these things because they seem so far outside of the realm of probability. So no one bothers to even try. And most prediction models don't include big enough outliers, essentially. Like, they only include the existing data. So, which is ridiculous because it's like, because you're trying to predict an outlier event
from existing
from a data set which has no outliers.
Yeah, that's weird.
So they're not in the models. They're not predictable because people just aren't trained to predict them, essentially. Yeah. So a very smart person who understands all this very well, much better than me, and they're a genius, might be able to predict certain things. But something like a book, like, what book's going to do well?
Yeah. I mean, we have, you know, a whole publishing industry trying to predict what books are going to do well. And are you saying from, like, this conversation that essentially they have no fucking clue?
I would say, okay, publishing is an interesting case. I think it's different to movies because, or and some other things in the creative world, because if you compare publishing to film, then a film just costs so much more money to make. So you're risking so much more.
Yeah.
It's just really hard to, I guess, you know, if you paid Stephen King, there's no advance you can pay Stephen King that means that if his book is a flop, your whole business
goes
tanks.
Under. Yeah. But I mean, if you're a small publisher.
I guess this is why now that they've consolidated to 5 big publishers, and these are multi-billion dollar companies.
Yeah.
A couple of badly placed $100,000 advances.
Yeah, it's not going to ruin anything.
But they might make it big for them because the book industry can benefit really strongly from a positive black swan.
Yeah,
like a good event, because they could give a $10,000 advance and that book might make hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. But it's not going to lose. They can only lose $10,000 for them.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
So the downside is much lower. Whereas a movie, yes, you can make, you know, independent art house films, and but then they don't have as much funding. So I feel like, as a proportion of how much, like, there just seems to be more risk involved in making a film, for example.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
But do you think that means that publishing can predict better?
Not predict, it's just that they have more, they can try more things.
Like, they can try more things.
They can just throw out more things.
Yeah.
And they can benefit. Like, publishing is actually quite a good industry. Like, if you look at publishing, they tick along. They're not making the same huge profits, but they tick along. You know, they make good money and they make good profits every year. They probably don't pay their
staff right,
or like their and their artists enough, but the owners make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And whereas, like, and yes, movies make more money, games make more money, but they just carry a lot more risk. Like, they're much more susceptible to you know, if you're a game studio and you make one game every 10 years and that game flops,
fuck,
you're dead, basically. Yeah. You're dead.
The pressure is so high.
Which is why I think there's a lot of power in being an independent artist, because if you just make films on YouTube using your camera, like, you can't really blow up. Negatively. Yeah. You can blow up positively.
Yeah, you can black swan the good way.
So, like, early career artists really have... They can only really benefit upside-wise. Like, yeah, you can have some opportunity costs, you know, the hours you devote to your career, to your art might come to nothing, maybe. Yeah. So you've lost a few hours.
Yeah.
But hopefully, I mean, I guess if you've done an MFA and taken on $100,000 in debt
or something, you've got risk.
Then maybe you've got more risk. But
yeah.
And that's sort of a reason why I would say don't do a lot of study around the arts, because you're just bringing risk into something that doesn't require it. And you could be so much more free, and you'd be, your downside is so much lower, and the upside that degree gives you is probably going to be so much lower as well.
I agree,
it's like not really worth it. But
I mean, there's always personal opinion there, but I agree with that. I mean, you can be so free.
Yeah.
And you can do so much stuff, and you can take on like so little risk for so much reward.
And then when I think about our career, so we never really had to go into debt to do anything. Like, we just built around, to start out, we built around stuff we were already doing. Like, you know, we didn't put anything on credit cards really. Or
after we paid off my credit card though.
Sorry, yeah. Well, you'd already accrued debt for being unemployed for like 6 months. But that was debt you were always going to accrue. It wasn't from
trying to create.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, it was. Anyway,
but what I'm saying is the direct action of building your business didn't
put us into debt.
It's like, you know, we had our website cost, and that was the main, you know, you have to buy a laptop maybe if you're a writer.
Yeah. It's low.
It's not like it's not like buying a house, which can have a huge downside risk, because if it loses all its value, then you essentially are fucked.
Yeah.
Like, I
think a lot of creatives have come undone at this point, and they want to invest huge amounts, and they want to do the fucking massive project first. And I first of all, like, I see you if that's a pattern that you find yourself falling into, because I get that. Like, I love having big goals, and I love huge projects. Like, we just watched, on a slight tangent, we watched, for the first time for me, I watched Bo Burnham's Inside, which is like a comedy musical special that this man made in the pandemic, and it's such a huge creative project, and I'm immediately completely obsessed. I'm like, that is something I want to do. I want to do something on that scale. It's incredible. Like, I get why scale is appealing, but I also think you can take risks that don't include financial risks.
But also, Bo took no risks doing that. It's Netflix who took the risk.
That's true.
Netflix paid him $4 million. That's a really, it was actually a smart decision from them, because $4 million for a show for them is really low.
But I guess if he did it himself, it would have been a high risk.
If he did it himself.
Well, it was so much equipment, so much education, so much time.
I mean, how much it would have cost him personally, maybe $100,000 to make that, which is more money than most people can afford.
Yeah.
But he was already an established artist.
Yeah.
And he would have paid $4 million for it. So
then you're right. So even the big visions, they don't need to be.
Yeah, but
he was.
If he'd done a whole movie, then that's a different level of risk again.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry.
We're just not trained to think about risks. And we are. And, you know, from behavioral economics, we know, and behavioral psychology, we know, we're just really, really, really bad at processing risk. And we don't understand it. We don't understand it. Our brains can't understand it. We're not natural risk takers. And I think that a lot of these big corporations, and Nassim Taleb would say, the problem with these big gatekeeping corporations is that they're filled with employees. Employees are not natural risk takers. They're not street smart about risk. If you own your own business, you have skin in the game. So you naturally get very used to what risks you should and shouldn't take, how not to get suckered into things, what's a good use of your time. And you don't make decisions unless you feel like it's a good decision. Which is not to say we never take risks or we never make bad decisions. It's just like, if you're an employee at a gatekeeping company, the worst thing that can happen to you is that you lose your job, which can be really bad.
Yeah.
It can be really, really bad. But you're not losing your business, and you're not losing your like reputation so much. I mean, I guess you could lose a bit of your reputation, but the business as a whole is not taking a big risk based on your actions, and therefore if you do something wrong, it's like, even for the business, it's not a huge deal.
I understand.
It's kind of hard. It is hard to explain.
It's interesting.
Like, they're not that, if you're an employee taking an action on behalf of a company, you're not really taking any risk. It's like the company's taking risk via you.
Yeah.
But if you're an independent artist or a business owner, then you have to constantly take risks. So you have a more intuitive grasp of risk often. And often entrepreneurs and business owners do naturally get these concepts a bit more.
Yeah. And I think when we say entrepreneurs and business owners, we're talking about artists as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
for
artists
sure.
have to constantly take risk.
Yes, they do.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting.
But it is interesting that we're bad at it.
We are really bad at it sometimes. But like, because we're scared, because the world teaches us as artists that we're not safe.
Yeah.
Whereas the way we should think about it is that often a lot of us can do things that are quite low risk that have a potentially high reward.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that everything's going to work out.
Yeah.
But it's just that our actions really do have the chance of massively succeeding for us.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, like, I'm not even saying, I know we often talk about the medium well-performing artists. Like, that's what we would consider ourselves. You know, yeah. We're people in creative industry who do medium well.
We do medium well, yeah.
And that for us is a huge upside, like, versus our old life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was a huge win. Like, we benefited from essentially you taking a lot of, not in a sense risk, but you taking a lot of pulls on the slot machine.
Yeah, I did.
When you
pull a slot machine every day, baby.
You know, for 10 years, essentially, you pull a slot machine. And, you know, 10 years, some people might send me a lot of terms. Some people, it's like, well, I've been doing it for 10 years and I haven't pulled my slot machine. And of course, maybe you never will pull the jackpot on the slot machine. But the fact of the matter is that you did a lot of pulls.
Yeah.
And therefore, you gave yourself and you stayed in the game for a long time and you gave yourself a lot of chances. It really did take you 8 years before you were making a comfortable living, I feel like, from...
Comfortable, yeah. Like, comfortable. Yeah.
From writing... and coaching combined.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, which is interesting.
It's super interesting.
And I feel like what we shouldn't do from that is try and build in a narrative, or, you know, it's called survivorship bias. So it's like you if you try and build a story based on what Amy and I have done, then you're not seeing the people who did very similar things to us who didn't work out for. So it's, so that's why you often shouldn't narrativize people's success. So I think as creatives, you know, we get people on the podcast and we try and unpack like how they were successful. I guess the point is I think we're pretty good at trying not to unpack the how did you do it? Like, why were you so successful? Yeah. I mean, we'll try and unpack the why and the thought process.
What was your story?
What's your story?
Because like trying to make these equations for what... equates to a creative success does seem, I mean, like, I intuitively know it's useless
because there's so much randomness involved. So it's like something that worked for someone won't work for someone else. But we find it very invigorating to hear about it still. But
of course, and again, I want to come back to this idea that what if this, I mean, to me sometimes, I know you, James, you find this an incredibly liberating conversation, but to me sometimes it makes me feel hopeless if we can't get, you know, if we can't listen to these stories and narrativize these success stories and then learn from them as to how we can be successful. If we can't understand, you know, ways in which we can, you know, become creatively abundant because there's too much randomness at play, like how do we feel empowered? I don't understand how we can feel empowered.
Because the point is not to look at the specific, like Stephen King writes X words a day at this time, therefore that's what I have to do, and if I do that I will be successful. It's like to look at the macro, you know.
Yeah, step back
and think about, well, okay, if you're talking about success, what's something that, if I want to be a successful writer, obviously a common thing is that I have to develop a creative practice.
Yeah.
Generally. That's going to be something that has to work for me.
Yeah.
That is something that you are going to have to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be a specific way that, like, I can't tell you a specific way to do it. I can maybe give you some inspiration and you can take some things from what other people do and you can try things and see what works for you. But there's not going to be some kind of formula that you can follow.
Yeah.
And that's cool because you get to do it yourself.
Yeah. It puts you in the authority seat.
Like, yeah.
And I think it's also scary for people because they don't want to have to choose to do it by themselves. They don't want to have to figure it out on their own. They want someone to tell them.
Yes.
But I think that it's way more fun this way.
Yeah, because it means that, you know, you don't have to feel stressed when you hear about someone doing something you're not doing. And you're like, oh my God, I'm not doing that.
Mm.
And I think people can get really caught up on this on social media and in business because they look at like the 10 things you have to do to have a thriving Instagram account or the 10 business decisions you have to make right now. And it's like, none of those things are useful. Yeah. Really, I mean, they might be useful on a macro level, but like they're not going to be relevant to you. They might give you inspiration, they might give you something to bounce off, but I don't feel like they're, it's, and by the time those lists come out, they're probably obsolete already anyway.
We were talking recently about this obsession with the like 33 laws, 12 laws, these books with the
certain number of laws,
and it's just like we're obsessed with this idea that we can simplify the very complex
because it does really well in the algorithm and it does really well on the bookshelf.
Yeah.
Because people go, oh great, finally there are 33 rules that I can follow.
Yes.
And if I follow them, I'm going to be successful. But it's like the world is so random.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of these laws are just sort of junk science packaged together into some kind of like, I don't know, bland
narrative,
bland narrative, or someone is, or it's someone retelling stories of famous people and trying to fit some kind of narrative to it, which is just, and also like a lot of these people, you know, were coming up in a different time to you, or it's like a boomer trying to give a millennial advice on how to get a job. It's completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
So figure it out. You know, you might have to figure it out yourself.
Yeah, is that... exactly. Yeah. I think this comes back down to self-authority and knowing you and having the confidence to back you, your intuition, what you want to do, back the art you want to make, and to understand that that's literally the correct path for you to do it. And even if, you know, something doesn't work out, you have to redo it, you have to pull the slot machine in a different way. Like, everything you're doing, you have to do on your terms.
Yes.
And so yeah, it comes back to that self-authority, which is something I've been writing about a lot. Like, so frequently I come back to, well, you are the authority on this creative journey. Like, what are you doing? This has to be on you.
I mean, that's why I really like your nonfiction, because you're very rarely telling people this is exactly how you beat procrastination. It's like, maybe examine yourself and look inside and try and think about what might be causing your procrastination, and then you might have an answer about how you could deal with it yourself.
It always comes back to us, and I think that's a very unsexy thing to sell.
Yeah, it can be, for
sure. And as I, you know, try and write and, you know, explore these ideas, I always come across this concept of, this is so complex, this is so nuanced, it doesn't sound sexy. And it's not really sellable.
Yeah.
But this is, I think, the stuff that brings us back home and brings us back to our power and brings and makes us incredible artists.
I think another thing you can think about is that you want to be looking at things that have survived for a long time. And this is the Lindy effect.
I was literally just about to say, you know, is it worth looking at things that haven't changed?
Yes.
You know, and is it worth looking at what has maintained a long time?
Yeah. So I think it's like, this is concept called the Lindy effect, which is that the longer something's been around, the more robust it is, and therefore the more it can deal with change, and the more it can deal with randomness. So these are things that are gonna, you know, so that company that's been around for 10 years is more likely to be around for 10 more years than, you know, a company that's only been around for 1 year is only likely to be around for another year.
The perennial seller.
Yeah, or a book. So there's a filtering effect with books. So there are, you know, a lot of books that have been made over the years, but sometimes it looks like they're only, you know, a small collection of classics that came from a certain era. It's because there's been a filtering effect, so more robust books that have been more able to deal with cultural change have survived, and then therefore they have a core value that is more perennial because it's already survived change, so it's probably likely to survive more change.
Yeah, it's super interesting.
You know, example
me.
Would be Jane Austen or
like even
the Iliad or something.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking a little closer to home, like thinking about The Artist's Way and that effect that it has. Like, it's just something that just keeps going.
The Artist's Way has been around for 30 years.
I'm super interested in that.
It's much more likely to still be around for another 30 years than another book that's going to come out tomorrow and sell really well.
Yeah.
It's much, much more likely.
So interesting.
So those ideas that seem to survive for a lot longer do seem to have to be more robust. They're not necessarily right, but they've certainly... There've been ideas that have survived more
change. Yeah.
Which is interesting.
And so do you think, I mean, maybe this is a silly concept, but like, do you think we should be looking at these things and taking ideas from them, taking inspiration from them and for our art?
I suppose so. I want to warn against, old things are always best, because that's not necessarily true. And also we live in a time of even more change. And like, we've had so much cultural change and I mean, we're really accelerating cultural change. Not that I want to, although I do like to avoid exceptionalism. I don't really like to say that we're in
an exceptional time.
Yeah, but we are in a sense, you know, there's a lot more change because of social media. The rate of change does seem to be increasing. So we'll see what survives that. And it's hard. And, you know, sometimes there are things in these old books that their core might be really good. An example is Julia Cameron, is that obviously we both of us really love The Artist's Way. It was your foundational book, basically.
Yes.
But there are some things from The Artist's Way that maybe aren't relevant anymore.
Yeah, definitely.
And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't, I mean, everyone should still read The Artist's Way, and it's still going to be valuable for years and years and years, but it doesn't mean take every single lesson from The Artist's Way and say that it's gospel.
Yeah.
Tim Ferriss was saying the other day that he doesn't think anything in his first book, The 4-Hour Work Week, is still relevant. He doesn't think any of the specific skills are still relevant, but he thinks it still sells because the core ideas are relevant still.
That's so interesting.
He says you can't follow a single tactic from that book anymore. Like, the systems don't even exist, basically.
I tried to read it and I was like, this is an old book.
Yeah. And he's like, so none of those tactics work anymore, but the core message is this, it still works.
So interesting.
Yeah.
This is a very interesting conversation, Jamesy. I know you've been a bit stressed out because you have a lot to say.
I'm so stressed right now.
I can tell.
It's just like, you know, it feels like I half studied for an exam.
Oh, it's just a conversation.
And the exam was on a 5,000 word book, and I read it once, and I'm now trying to remember everything.
Do you mean page?
Sorry, page book. 5,000 page book. And I'm now trying to remember everything in that book.
You've done a really good job.
Oh, man.
Are you tired? Are you going to crash?
Maybe.
Yeah, you did a really good job. I think this is really interesting, and this is something that, like, artists need to be accessing. I think this is a conversation that often happens in the economic space and, like, in these entrepreneurial spaces, but artists need to be talking about this too.
Mm.
Do you agree with that?
I mean, of course.
Mm.
I often think that the best books for artists to read are not necessarily... I think you should read art books and craft books and books about art. But I don't think that's all you should read.
Yeah.
I think you should be trying to... I love cross-disciplinary...
Yeah, me too.
...people.
I just often think that artists get left on the wayside and, like, aren't... Like, they're almost, like, spoken to seriously.
Yeah, like, oh, you wouldn't get it.
You probably wouldn't understand.
There's some maths here, so sorry.
Yeah, I know that's not your thing. It's like, shut up. We deserve to have these conversations too. Like, they're really important to have.
Yes.
Anyway, really good job, James.
Thanks. I tried.
You did a really good job.
I tried really hard. I even wrote notes. I even tried to prepare, but...
James, you spoke really well.
Okay, thank you, Amy.
Do you have anything else you want to make sure you get to?
No.
Learned a lot.
Great.
So that's one thing.
To be fair, you've never been able to sit down and listen to me talk about this for an extended period because I feel like you found it really boring.
I didn't find it boring.
This time I feel like you... But like every time when I've been trying to tell you
James,
about it...
James, sometimes you talk to me at inopportune moments.
That's true.
Like, I'm trying to do other stuff. I'm trying to live my life.
Or, like, for example, on our walk today, so I'm listening to the Iliad at the moment, and I was trying to explain to Amy what was going on.
You sound like a super fucking nerd right now.
I am a huge nerd.
That's true.
I'm so sorry. And, by the way, listen to the Iliad. I've tried, you know, I had to read the Iliad for uni. Hard slog. Super hard slog. But listening to it has been really fun. And I was trying to explain to Amy what was happening with Agamemnon and Achilles, and you were walking, and you go, Fluffy! And you just, like... ignore me, walk over to this caterpillar and just start pointing at it.
It was a fluffy
and
caterpillar.
And I was like, I'm trying to explain an idea to you right now.
It was so fluffy.
Yeah. But I'm just saying,
James,
sometimes...
I'm saying sometimes...
Was that an inopportune moment or did you just choose a caterpillar over me?
Sometimes I'm not in the mood.
Fair enough.
Sorry. But that was a really good conversation.
Good. I had a captive audience, so that was nice.
Yeah. I want to continue this conversation because I think it has impacts on our business as creatives, and I'm really excited about it. I'm particularly excited about this idea of, like, what hasn't changed and what are the ideas that are robust and how do we use them and integrate them, and I find that conversation really interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, do we have any news?
It's very dark in England now. I wasn't ready for it.
I know. We had a bit of a...
It's kind of nice because you kind of just can give up on your day when the sun goes down and that's at 4:30.
I do like doing that.
So that's great.
I do like to give up early. We've got the fire on.
It's really cozy.
We're going for a lot of walks.
We didn't do a video today for some reason.
James, sometimes it's hard.
I don't know if any of you listen to the... Or watch the... Sorry, you might listen to the video. But do you watch the video? I don't think so.
It's just too much.
We kind of just have it in case we ever want to put it on YouTube, I think. But you know what? They'll just miss this episode.
Sometimes there's just a lot to do with a business and being... And I'm tired.
I know they all switch off at this point. Like, you can see it in our metrics.
Have you?
Like, not all of them, but it goes from quite good retention rate in our episodes to a huge...
Stop.
You know, like, it goes from 90% of listening this far, and then in the last few minutes... But I think it's because the super fans, as soon as they start realizing that we ramble, only the super fans stay on. Like, obviously, we've been rambling for 5 minutes now.
So. I feel really bad. That makes me feel really embarrassed.
Yeah, they just switch off if they don't want to listen. It's okay.
Okay.
I'm grateful if you're still here.
Yeah, we love you very much. We're grateful.
And
we love you.
If you stay to this point, maybe you're going to get this super secret, which is...